Welcome to Fantasy Feud, a pitcherless baseball podcast where we're tackling the most relevant debates in fantasy baseball each week. I'm Sarah Sanchez, and as always, I am joined by my co-host Shelley Verstraete to talk through both sides of the hottest fantasy baseball debates right now with some of the greatest minds in the industry. And we have a treat for y'all this week because it's been a weird year for top prospects, with some getting off to slower starts, some really excelling. And we have a great guest to talk through all things prospects with. So I'll probably moderate a bit more today and just let Shelley and our guest hash out some of these prospect debates. But how are you thinking about the rookies on your teams as we settle into August, Shelley?
I'm happy that I did not drop Jackson Gerio. I benched him for, you know, like the first like month and a half. But I'm glad I have him on my team. And you know, I'm glad I didn't pay up for other prospects. But yeah, it's been a very interesting time with, you know, random guys coming up and doing well and some not doing well. It's been an interesting year.
It has been, and there's been some funky paths to development this year too. We have a bunch of rookies who came over from playing professional ball overseas. We have rookies who like just bypassed the minor leagues altogether, right? Like you've got Paul Skeens is like, I'm going to throw seven innings and then I'm going to be in AAA and now I'm going to be the best pitcher in the major leagues. And that's just a wild thing to have develop. I don't think I've seen anything like that in my time watching the sport. So lots of good stuff to jump into today. And we have the perfect guest for it. We're excited to welcome Eric Cross to the show. You know Eric from his work at FTN Fantasy and Roto Baller. He is also the host of the excellent Toolshed Pod and truly one of my go-to people for all things prospects. How's it going, Eric?
It's going well. And it's funny. I feel like we say it's been a weird year for prospects every year, but it's always like for different reasons, you know, like that's why one of the many reasons why, you know, I love this game so much is that, you know, like in other sports, you know, most of the big guys, they come up and do well, but it's like baseball so unpredictable. Like, who would have thought Tyler Fitzgerald would be doing what he's doing right now, and that, you know, Jackson Holliday would struggle initially and all the other ups and downs of the rookies. But that's what makes it fun. It's so unpredictable. But that's why this game is so great.
Yeah, so many variables, so many different paths, so many things to learn. And every time you think you have baseball figured out, it will humble you because that is what it is designed to do. Just as a reminder for anyone who's new to the show, this is a debate podcast, so we do things a little bit differently here. We're going to tackle six different topics throughout the show through a series of mini debates. Each debater is going to get 3 minutes to make their case. There's a period of questions after that where they will either ask questions of each other or the moderator will ask questions of the debater. And if we have not hashed everything out thoroughly at that point in time, there's still rebuttals to be had. We will do a 1 minute rebuttal for each debater. Sometimes we just kind of find ourselves on the same side of things and there's no point in repeating ourselves for a 1 minute rebuttal. So we'll kind of make that call as we go through, but we're really excited to jump right in. And so we will with some rookies who I think we've already mentioned a couple of these guys. According to the Fangraphs player rater, the highest value rookie position players in a 15-team 5x5 roto this season has been Jackson Merrill at $21.6, 40th player overall. That includes both pitchers and position players. It's like kind of the meta universe that you can look at there. The next most valuable position player with rookie eligibility is Zidane Rafaela at $16.6, 75th overall. And just behind him is Jackson Churio at $16, 81st overall. They're exceeding their value. But none of these guys, except for maybe Churio, were really the talk of the rookie class coming in. It was probably somebody like Holliday, maybe somebody like Wyatt Langford instead. And so I guess my question for y'all today to kick us off is, which rookie position player, either from above or from the field, do you think will wind up with the highest value in 2024? And what can we learn from that? And Eric, as our guest, we'll start with you.
Yeah, so I'll go Jackson Merrill here. I think he's the one I feel safest about finishing as the one. Obviously, it helps that he's already, you know, leading the way. Churio obviously has the upside, and we've seen him go on, you know, really hot stretches this year. We've also seen the really cold stretches. So Merrill's been pretty consistent. He had that power binge, I believe it was in June, where he had like 9 home runs in 12 games. But for the most part, he's been very consistent this year. He doesn't have the flashy, loud tools that like Churio or Langford have, but if you go take a gander at his Savant page, it's just, you know, outside of, you know, he chases too much, doesn't walk that much, but the rest of the metrics are all pretty good. Like, it's just pretty consistent across the board, where, you know, he's above average quality of contact. He has 10% barrel, 43% hard hit rate. EV's right around 90 miles an hour. He's above average contact overall as well, 86% in zone, and then right around 80% overall. Like, he doesn't walk much, but doesn't strike out much either. And right now he's on pace for, you know, he's at 17 home runs, 13 steals, and he's hitting .290. And he's really been hitting even better over the last 6 weeks or so. I think he's hitting, I tweeted about it earlier today, like .313 or something like that over the last 6 weeks. So the fact that he's kind of slowly getting better and better as the season progresses, he's probably going to finish with something like, 22, 23 home runs, maybe 16, 17 steals, get up near 80 runs and run 80 RBI as well. Just give you that well-rounded offensive profile. And yeah, Churio, absolutely. He's been pretty hot, late as well. So he's kind of charging hard here. So it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest if Churio were to pass Merrill over the next, 5 weeks or whatever we get left of the regular season. But, Merrill's a guy that I was even a little too low on when I was ranking him coming in this year. I ranked him pretty high, but not as high as I should, because it was kind of, like a boring profile. But, boring helps, Sexy doesn't always win championships, and guys like Jackson Merrill you need on your team. So I'm feeling pretty confident in the metrics and what we're seeing from Merrill here, and I think he's gonna. I don't see any reason for him to not keep doing what he's doing and finish the season pretty strong. So I'll go Jackson Merrill here.
I love that call. And one of the things that you said there, kind of boring but good. Like, I think that is what has been helping the Padres this season. It's also one of those things fantasy players talk about with veteran players all the time, is this sort of like, don't go for the flashy upside, go for the standard guy who's going to play every day and who you can get for lesser value. I think it's a great call out. Shelly, who is your player here, and why do I have a hunch it will not be my guy, Sedane Rafaela?
Because I got to keep the bit going, Sarah. I just got to keep going. But for me, it's going to be Churio. I think that he's going to make a really late push. I mean, I was low on Merrill too, because I mean, he was learning a new position. He never hit he never played AAA. So he was coming up from AA and played a new position. It was just like, I think he's probably going to struggle. I mean, Merrill was kind of like one of the guys that the Padres were like, no, we're not going to trade. And that kind of was like, but yeah, he's definitely overperformed what I thought he was going to do. But I think it's going to be Churio is going to make a late push. The Brewers, they pretty much have the NL Central locked up. And they don't have Yelich anymore. And Churio's hitting second, right, in that lineup. Merrill's hitting sixth in the Padres lineup. So if Churio can, keep doing what he's doing, because since July 1st, he's hitting .313, .361, .510 with a .142 WRC+, which is, that's pretty nice. He might make a late push to get up to where Merrill's at, but if not, it's going to be a really, really good NL Rookie of the Year kind of watch at the end of the season.
Yeah, to be clear, you do not have to apologize to me for letting me know that the Cubs are not very good. I wrote a piece earlier today excoriating this team for going over the luxury tax with a 500 baseball team, but that is a conversation for my other podcast. Good stuff here. I'm curious, Shelly, I'm going to start with you. You mentioned something with Churio in particular that I think is really important that we talk about with veteran guys all the time. He just has a playing time opportunity here. And because of the Yelich injury, the sky is kind of the limit. The Brewers just need Churio to be that dude. And I feel like his numbers and maybe his value being lesser than where Jackson Merrill's is right now is more of a function of him struggling when he came up. And now he's just kind of off to the races. Is that what you see as well?
Yeah, that's what I see. I've loved Churio for quite a while. He brings, power and speed, and he can hit, for a decent average. He's one of those all complete prospects that you very rarely see. So, yeah, I think that, he could probably, have some big games for the Brewers going down the stretch, and he might be able to, eke out Merrill by the end of the season.
Yeah, great stuff. Jackson Merrill, I want to go back to this for your pick, Eric, because Jackson Merrill's one of those guys we weren't even sure was going to get called up. He kind of got a late push in draft season when it became clear that the Padres were going to give him that run. And then there were questions about playing time, where he was going to get those opportunities. Just kind of quietly put together a really exceptional fantasy baseball season. What is it about him as a prospect that you think allowed him to do that? And is there anything we can learn there that would inform how we would look at future prospects?
I think, you know, with him, he's always been one of the more advanced hitters, I think. And those are the types of guys that seem to transition more seamlessly. You know, obviously not always. We saw that with Holiday. Even he had some issues early on. But you see these guys that just know how to hit, know how to put the bat on the ball. And again, he doesn't walk a lot. He's not taking a lot of pitches. But when you have the contact rates that he does and that he's really always had, he's always been a guy that has, you know, run higher contact rates, doesn't strike out, and that's huge. Like, you see him never had any issues with, you know, too much swing and miss in the profile. And yeah, that's the kind of why I was not super high on him. I don't think I had any shares this year, unfortunately, in redraft, but I did have one dynasty share, which kind of eased that pain a little bit. But yeah, it was really like a late spring, late, you know, March push where we're like, oh, hey, like, this was like a fun little, oh, like, you know, late February, oh, maybe Jackson Merrill can fit into their plans earlier in the year. And then it became, this is going to happen. And, you know, ADP, I'm sure it pushed up 100 or more picks over the last, you know, week of March. But that kind of shows like all the big names that San Diego had, and, you know, the Machados, the Bogarts, the Tatises, et cetera, that it's been, you know, Jackson Merrill has been their most steady performer all year. So, and it shows that when you have those contact skills, and you don't strike out a lot, you can usually transition more seamlessly than others.
It's a great point. That contact skill is one of those things that really can differentiate you here. I think we do still have enough fodder here for some rebuttal. So I'm going to give Shelley 1 minute to make her final case for her Jackson, and then I will give Eric a minute to make his case for his Jackson. And I also want to know what was going on in the years where these kids were born, where everybody is named Jackson, but that's a question for a different day. Shelley, go ahead.
Yeah, I've been actually meaning to go back to be like, when were they born? And like, who was a big time actor or something that was named Jackson? Because it's kind of weird. But anyway, Churio, he's made like this extremely late push to like come out from a bad season. I think he's just going to go over and overtake Merrill. But honestly, if you had any of these guys on your team, you are pretty darn happy.
10-10, totally agree. Eric, make the case for your Jackson of the Merrill variety.
Yeah, like I said, he's not as flashy. He's not as loud. He doesn't have quite the same upside as Churio does. And I don't think anybody would say that he has more upside. But again, like I just feel more confident in, you know, him not going through, you know, a little bit of a slump over, you know, the next 4 or 5 weeks. And maybe Churio won't. And, you know, like both Shelley and I have said, he's been hitting well and, you know, could finish season really strong. But I just feel more confident looking at the profile. It's a bit of a safer profile. And that's where I kind of lean these days after being burnt a lot by the unsafe profile. I'm not saying Churio's profile is unsafe, but feel a bit safer about Merrill finishing the season on a high note.
Great stuff. All right. Thanks for kicking off our first debate there. We're going to turn over to Shelley to moderate our second debate.
Yeah, so let's, you know, flip it over and let's talk about pitchers. So the highest value starting pitcher so far this season is, not a shocker, it's Paul Skenes. It's always going to be Paul Skenes because he's amazing. And he has earned $19.80, which is 53rd overall. And next up is Shota Imagina, $17.76, 65th overall. Sorry, Shota, I'm still trying to get your last name right. I apologize. Which rookie pitcher will be the highest value at the end of the season, and what can we learn from that? Sarah, how do I pronounce Shota's name, please?
I mean, in fairness to you and both of us, like, I have been pronouncing it back and forth all year because I learned it wrong and then I had to learn it right. And so I believe it is Shota Imanaga, but I'm like truly Imanaga. Like I mix it up all the time, and now I'm going to mess it up on my own podcast. So I'm just going to say Shota for this entire time and try to get myself out of that one. Shota is my guy here, and it's for a structural reason more than a talent reason. I think if you're looking at, like, over the course of their career, who is going to be the best major league pitcher long term, I think it is Paul Skenes, and I think it's not close. But I think that from a head-to-head this season, who is going to get the most done with the last month and change of the of what is left of the Major League Baseball season, I think it's Shota, and I think it's pretty definitive. Paul Skenes is already kind of slowing down a bit. We can see his velocity ticking down start to start, and look, like, if you're sitting 97.6, that's not that big of a drop off from when you were sitting 99.2. But, like, truly, like, we can already see some warning signs with Paul Skenes in terms of the workload he's experiencing, which is higher than anything he has ever taken on. And I am known on this podcast for having drafted Paul Skenes in, like, the middle rounds of one of my most important drafts. And I held on to him, and I'm glad I did. He is part of the best starting pitching staff that I have ever rostered in my entire life. And I'm glad I took that shot. I'm glad I took him over Nestor Cortez when I was having that internal debate in my head and the clock was running. And also, if I had only one roster spot for the rest of the season for Shota or Paul Skenes, I would give it to Shota because I don't think that he's going to have any injury issues going through the end of the season. I think the Cubs are just in it enough that they have no incentive to try to shut him down or anything like that. They need every Shota start to go to the wire as much as possible. And the Pirates are just out of it enough that where they might start to wonder, hey, what if we save these, like, 25 innings for Paul Skenes for later? And so I think that for the year of our Lord 2024, Shota is the dude. And for the remainder of all of their time in Major League Baseball, Paul Skenes with a bullet, and he's going to go way ahead of Shota next year, and he should.
Yeah. These two pitchers I do like to watch whenever they do pitch. I find them extremely different and both fascinating to watch at the same time. Eric, so I guess you got Skenes. Come on, give it to me. What you got?
Yeah, this one was maybe the most difficult one for me because I have those concerns about, you know, when and if Pirates kind of shut down or limit Skenes this year. And I also love Shota. I absolutely love Shota. I have a lot of Shota shares, both Redraft and Dynasty, and he's been an absolute godsend to my pitching staffs this year, especially that run he had early in the season where it was absolutely phenomenal. So a lot of love for Shota from this corner. But, you know, I've been looking at Skenes here, and – you know, look at 2023. He pitched 122 and two-thirds innings for LSU and then 6 2/3 in the minor leagues after the draft. So that is 129 and a third innings. This year, he's at 125 and a third between AAA and the majors. 98 with Pittsburgh, 27 and a third in AAA. So I kind of get a feel like, you know, maybe they do shut him down at some point, but – you know, natural progression. I can see him going another, you know, 15, 20 innings over last year. So that would give him another 20 to 30 innings this year. So maybe he gets another 5-6 starts. Maybe they limit him to like 4 innings, kind of like what the White Sox are doing with Crochet lately. So that kind of gives me a little hope that maybe they don't shut him down right away, because you would definitely want to go with Shota then, because there's really, I don't think, any, you know, concern about Shota getting shut down or anything like that. You mentioned the Cubs are still kind of in it. Pittsburgh's not really in it. Usually they aren't. But, you know, if Skenes can get, let's say, 80% of the innings that Shota gets, and you got to figure out, like, how many more innings is Shota going to throw? I mean, we got, what, 35, 40 games left. So let's say that's like 7 starts, 5.5, 6 innings per start, you know, upper 30s, maybe around 40 innings. So if Skenes can get to like 30 innings and get 3/4 or a little more of that, I think the value per inning, you know, I think is going to get him right up there, and maybe he'll keep that lead that he currently has over Shota on that player rate. So, you know, obviously in the long term, like you know, like you mentioned, Sarah, it's Paul Skenes, though. I think Shota's going to be a very good arm for a very long time as well. But I'm just kind of holding on hope that he gets enough innings to kind of maintain that lead, you know, over the last 5 weeks of the season.
Yeah, I mean, Skenes has been phenomenal, but I do have a question for you, Eric, when it comes to Skenes. Does his increase in walk rate kind of concern you? The last, 5 games, so 0 walks, 3 walks, 3 walks, 1 walk, 4 walks. And the strikeouts are still kind of around the same rate. We have 8-6-4, 8-6. So does it concern you that maybe he is starting to get a little bit tired and he's going to lose a little bit of his, you know, command, and maybe he'll let up more home runs? And then, you know, we've already been talking about the, you know, the Pirates being where they are and they might limit him. Does that kind of concern you a bit? Because you know what you're going to get relatively from Shoto.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It definitely is at least somewhat concerned. I'm not like sitting here like really worried about it, because he's never really had any sort of walk rate issue. And obviously it was much better for, you know, the first 12 starts. I mean, he only had 13 walks in his first 12 starts and then 11 in his last four. So it's almost the same amount in the last four as the first 12. So that is a little concerning. I'm wondering, you know, is it, if he's purposely dialing it back a little bit to, you know, we mentioned, you know, the decreased velocity over the last, you know, few starts. Wonder if that's by design, either something he wanted to do, something Pittsburgh was telling him to do. Maybe he's kind of just learning to live with that different velocity band, you know, take a couple of ticks off the fastball. But yeah, that definitely is a little bit of concern. He's still pitching pretty well, you know, ERA, you know, it's not as well, good as it was, but ERA is still 3.47 over the last four starts here. So yeah, I'm still holding the hope that this is kind of by design and not something that'll kind of keep hindering him moving forward.
Yeah, I think it's also depends on, like, you know, who he was facing. He was facing the Dodgers and Houston a couple times. So
that's true. Yeah.
You know, pretty good lineup. So maybe I'm making a mountain out of a molehill there. Sarah, when it comes to Shota, you know, you're a resident, you know, Cubs fan. And we all knew that he had a home run, like a huge home run rate when he was over in Japan. Does the increase in home run rate over the season, does it concern you? Is it what you expected? Do you think it's because it's warmer outside, you know, in the summer? Like, what are your thoughts about that?
I think it does concern me. And I also think that the weather impacts it quite a bit. It's a really weird thing to see. So I've noticed a couple of things with Shota, because I've watched every start of his that I could in person, and every start on TV that I didn't see in person. And a couple of things have jumped out at me. One is, a handful of teams have had a really good game plan against Shota. So they come in and they're either sitting splitter or they're sitting high four seam. And then that allows them to kind of neutralize the other pitch. And that contributes to their ability to just launch off against him when they're able to do that. The Mets did this really well. For example, a couple of other teams did too. Now, part of the reason the Mets were able to do that is they got an assist from the home plate umpire. When the home plate umpire is not calling the high fastball a strike, when it is a strike, Shota has to lower that fastball a little bit to get the strike call. And then now it's in like the hitter happy zone, where it's like, we're just going to launch this pitch over and over and over again. I do look at the flags at Wrigley on a Shota day more than anybody else, even though I don't think that, I mean, obviously, like, Javier Assad can get pounded on a day when the wind is blowing out at Wrigley too. Anybody can, right? Like, the wind blowing out at Wrigley is certainly not ideal pitching situation. The thing I've been really impressed with Shota is he's super self-aware. His nickname is the throwing philosopher, and he very much knows that that's a risk for him, and he plays to the weather conditions a little bit. Like, if the wind is blowing in, as it was when Shota faced the Dodgers, he was just letting them send fly balls out to the outfield over and over and over again. They weren't doing anything really, because it was just like, yeah, well, the wind is blowing in, have a nice day. I think this is one of the reasons that I give him a slight edge over Skeens now, but I'm not sure how long that edge lasts. I feel like Shota is toying with people. And this is one of the reasons that I think that guys who come over with like long-term careers in Japan or in Korea probably shouldn't be rookies for the same reason that pitching in Japan is a fundamentally different game than pitching in college. Like, these are not comparable things. And Skeens' experience is not the same as Shota's. Frankly, Yoshinobu Yamamoto's experience is not the same as Shota. Shota has multiple seasons of experience on top of what Yamamoto had, right? So I think that it does worry me. It worries me particularly in the, like, this is his weakness, we can see it. And it seems like concerns about Shota's home run rate were kind of overblown because he adapts really well and he's super situationally aware. And while that home run to fly ball ratio is higher than you would like it to be, everything else is good enough that it makes up for it, at least for now. That's a brilliant. It might go off as the contract signing of the offseason. I still can't believe Jed Hoyer got that deal done.
Wait, did you just compliment Jed Hoyer?
I did. Don't tell anyone.
Oh, I well, okay. I will not tell anyone. You told everyone. So I guess we'll go to rebuttals. Eric, give us your last words on Skeens.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, my picking Skeens really hinges on him throwing at least 25-30 innings, which is definitely a wild card here, and that might not happen. I mean, they could come out and shut him down tomorrow for all we know, but you know, I think just given how good Skeens has been, even though the last few starts haven't been as Skeens-esque as we saw the first 3 months of his career, the fact that he's basically been, if not the best pitcher in baseball since he debuted in the middle of May, one of the two or three best. It's basically been him and Tariq Skubal for the most part, you know, kind of battling back and forth this year. So generational talent, you know, all the upside in the world. And the fact that we saw that from day one, like there was no adjustment period. You know, hitters had to adjust to him coming in, throwing triple digit, you know, heat, that 92 mile an hour changeup, upper 80s slider. It's just like Jacob DeGrom-esque with what he's out there throwing. So if he can get at least 75 to 80% of the innings, which that Shota gets down the stretch, which I think is, you know, realistic, though a bit risky for sure, I think he can maintain that lead on the player radar and finish ahead of Shota.
All right, Sarah, tell us why you love Shota.
Because I'm a Cubs fan. No, but truly, a fun fact that I just discovered, Shota actually has a lower home run per fly ball rate than Paul Skeens at this moment in time. Now, truly, this is some small sample size magic, and Paul Skeens doesn't give up nearly as many fly balls as Shota does. Like, there's a little bit of metric going on here, but it's 11% versus 12.5%. And I do think that experience matters for something here. And one of the things that years ago when I was an old debate coach and I took my kids to a tournament at Wake Forest, I got a mug with my coffee on it that said, old age and treachery will defeat youth and skills. And I kind of laughed about it at the time, and the kids did too, because they were like, ah, ha, ha, they gave you the old person mug. But I feel like experience matters at this point in time, and it will for a while, which will make Shota a better pitcher than Paul Skeens. I will say, looking at the rest of season projections over on Fangraphs right now, they are almost identical for both pitchers, somewhere between 29 and 42 innings, somewhere between 30 and 45 strikeouts, somewhere between like 12 and 22 walks. So both of these guys are sitting in the same sort of wheelhouse. They're both super fun to watch. And while I think that Shota's going to win because he's got some experience, I think that Paul Skeens is going to be, he's going to go in the first two rounds next year, and he should.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I think, like, I mean, if I was doing like a big time, like NFBC draft where pitching goes, like maybe I'll take like Paul Skeens in the top five. I don't know how well that's going to do. I mean, I was advocating for Jacob DeGrom back in the day there, so, and he got hurt. So who knows?
Hey, I took Spencer Strider number two overall, and I still think the process behind that was good. And I, you know, he got hurt, but if he doesn't get hurt, that's the right pick when you're looking at guys where, you know, the guy who can be the difference maker for your team. And I was trying to build a pitching team and I didn't have the number one overall pick. So it was just one of those situations. And I think, Paul Skeens has that level of talent. It's going to be real fun to see what happens with him in draft season. We are going to take a quick break for our sponsors while we think about where we will take Paul Skeens next year in the first round. But on the flip side, we have some more debates coming back and you will not want to miss any of them. So make sure you stick around. All right. We are back. Our guest, Eric, is going to moderate our third debate.
All right. You two can retreat to your corners. I will be the moderator for this one, and we'll kind of play off the last one here. So speaking of Shota, who I've always said Imanaga, so this other pronunciation is kind of blowing my mind right now, so we'll have to figure that out at some point. But speaking of Shota, players coming over from Japan or other professional leagues offer quite the wrinkle comparing them to guys working their way through AAA. It's also not lost on me that neither Skeens nor Imanaga had a traditional route through the minors or just to the major leagues in general. So the question here is, Should fantasy managers be looking for rookies that don't have a traditional minor league development path in drafts, or has 2024 just been kind of fluky? Let's start with you, Sarah.
This is a fun question because I kind of think about things in processes and systems, and I'm always looking for patterns and things, and that's how I like to make decisions. And one of the things that I came to the conclusion on a few years ago is that looking at these guys who come over with international experience, you have to evaluate them a little bit differently. Like what, and there's two different ways that this happens, right? One is they were developed and played for an international league, and therefore they had a different ball. They had a different environment in terms of runs. They had a different environment in terms of how hitters approach them, et cetera. Or they came from Major League Baseball, a la like a Mike Tauchman or an Eric Fetty. They spent some time somewhere else and worked on a thing, and then they came back. And what does that look like? And I got the chance to ask Mike Tauchman about that from his time in Korea. It's really changed the way I thought about players in the sense that he had very specific things that he was worried about being able to do when he came back to Major League Baseball, and specifically the velocity that he was going to face from pitchers he knew was going to be so much different than what he had faced in Korea, that he was concerned that if he couldn't catch up to a Major League Baseball fastball, like that was just kind of it for him, right? Which led me to believe that there are some structural things going on. And given all things being equal, I think that I would take a player with professional experience somewhere else over the minor league baseball path as we know it, just because that extra professional experience, I think, demonstrates a level of competence and ability that is distinct from what happens in the American minor leagues. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is the minor leagues are set up right now to be a sort of laboratory of experiments for Major League Baseball. You've got a different ball in AA. You've got an automated ball and strike system in AAA. Like, they're trying to do a bunch of sandboxy things with the minor leagues that I think are fundamentally changing the nature of how the minor leagues develop players and what you can glean from those players. Like, one of the things that I've noticed this year looking at prospects coming up from AAA is that you have to go a little bit deeper than just their strikeout and walk rates to figure out how they're going to do against major league pitching, because the strikeout and walk rates change considerably with the implementation of an ABS in AAA. Similarly, if you're looking at pitchers, like a pitcher who comes up from AA in that tacky ball versus a pitcher who comes up from AAA in the ABS, they are coming into an environment that is fundamentally different, right? And so all things being equal, I think I would prefer international experience and somebody coming over from a professional league rather than coming from one of the minor league systems, just because of all the tweaks and changes that have been made there. But I'm real curious to hear what Shelley thinks here.
All right, Shelley, hop in.
It's pitching. I just think it's fluky. Like, seriously, because people get hurt. People, you know, I think that this, it's fluky, relatively speaking. I mean, Yuri Perez was great last year. And he was going to be great, but then he got hurt. But Tanner Bibee was pretty good, and he's done pretty well this year. Andrew Abbott was great last year, and he had a phenomenal time in AA with that tacky ball, racking up those strikeouts. But he's kind of had kind of like an up and down season. So for me, I look for skills. I read scouting reports, and I listen to many podcasts from people who go to mini games and people who don't go to as many games, and people who, you know, just look at the numbers and number crunch and stuff like that. I take all of that in and then kind of go from there. But at the end of the day, it's pitching. It's going to be a crapshoot. You know, you could have gone Sarah's route and drafted Kodai Senga before he got hurt this year, and you got one game. So I think it's all fluky. And sometimes you're going to get lucky. Sometimes you're not. Who knows? That's kind of how I feel about prospect pitchers. Who knows?
Yeah. Who knows is, I think, the perfect two words. Because, like, look at coming into the year, it's like, oh, Ricky Tiedemann's one of the best pitching prospects in baseball. And now he's fallen off and he's hurt again. Then you get guys like Brandon Sproat and Matt Wilkinson and Quinn Matthews that have skyrocketed up. Zevi Matthews, you know, the list goes on and on. So, yeah, I think that's why it was hard for me to, like, give an answer to this one, because I think it's a little bit of both. I think obviously there's different developmental paths and everyone is the same for every prospect, and pitching is just fluky in nature. But I got a question for each of you. I'll go back to Shelley first for this one. And given how fluky pitching is, you know, especially with the younger arms, has this kind of changed your philosophy in drafting younger pitchers in all of your drafts every spring?
I think so. I've never been a fan of drafting rookie pitchers because they scare me too much. I mean, pitchers in general scare me too much. But then again, I just said that I was going to take Paul Skene's top five. So we'll see how that goes next year. But I'm just always just kind of hesitant because we've never seen them at this level. And these hitters are the best hitters in the entire world, essentially. So I kind of back away. And yeah. So.
No, that is totally fair. And I'm kind of with you on that. Sarah, my question for you. Has the recent increased success from players coming over from Korea or Japan or wherever, you know, even guys that went over and came back, does that give you more confidence in drafting these types of players moving forward?
It really does. And honestly, like, I look at a handful of these guys and I'm like, why did they leave in the first place? Like, Mike Tauchman looks like the type of player who probably should have gotten a Major League Baseball option that would have kept him stateside. But he instead went to Korea. He's like a super on base percentage dude with a great contact skill and an above average glove. It's like that seems like a guy who should have just been playing here. However, I think from the pitching side of things, it's even more interesting, right? Like the pitchers who go over to a different league and learn how to work on things generally develop a different pitch or develop a different look than what they had before. And I'm thinking both about Miles Michaelis and Eric Fetty here. Neither of those dudes was as effective prior to their time spent in Korea, and both of them are more effective post that time. And whether that is how long that's sustainable for, how durable it is, but it is something that when a guy has made the transition and demonstrated a skill, I am interested in seeing how that skill plays in MLB and how long it lasts. And so far, the sample size that we have seems to indicate that it lasts pretty well.
All right, let's finish off with some rebuttals. Shelley, what do you got?
Pitching is fluky. Good luck for your drafts. And hopefully you get lucky on the waiver wire. That is my all responses to all pitcher questions.
No, that's fair. Do DeSoto or Orsillo have any comments on pitching?
Oh, they only have comments on hitting.
That's fair. That's fair.
Orsillo's growling. He's mad at my takes.
All right, Sarah, what do you got for your rebuttal?
I think that every draft season, at least I try to create a plan with this huge list of players in terms of who am I best going to set up my team with. And I want to approach, in particular, guys with less experience in the league with knowing as much information about them as possible. And in order to do that, I have to proxy some things based on previous guys who have done X or done Y. And players with international experience and what they have done when they have come back stateside or when they have first come stateside from an international league strikes me as a place where there's an opportunity to get value at a lower draft cost than what we traditionally see. And so it's not always there. Like Yamamoto got pushed really high up in drafts this season, probably because of the age and probably because of the number on his contract. But like, I think all of us agree that Shota was underdrafted this season by a lot. And that was just wild to watch it happen over and over and over again. Fetty also probably underdrafted this season by a lot. I mean, Mike Tauchman generally not drafted this season and probably had some sort of value for most rosters in terms of who are you taking with your last pick in the, you know, late rounds of a draft. That's a guy who has played a ton of at-bats. And so I think that this is a place where I consistently see players undervalued, and therefore it's a place that I am going to highlight on my draft boards as where I can find value.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Fede was so bad before he went over, and the fact that then he was over there for a year, was it a year or 2 years? I forget, but and then he came back. It was like, all right, yeah, it's almost like prove it to me before I even think about drafting. So yeah, I had unfortunately zero shares. I did pick up Fede in one or two leagues, thankfully, which helped. But yeah, I wasn't even like, I didn't even have him on my board. And even in like a 50 round draft, I'm like, I'll go after like that guy or that guy. He wasn't even on my board.
Yeah, I didn't wind up with much Fetty this year either, and I'm kind of kicking myself over it, which is why I'm willing to make the adjustment to be like, I'm going to just give these guys a little bit of a round or two bump in the future and see what happens. Great stuff, y'all. Thanks for that. We're going to move on to our next debate, which is going to focus on pitching in a little bit of a different, more forward-looking way since we're towards the end of the season here. Let's talk about next season. Over the past couple of seasons, some young pitchers have burst onto the scenes. We had Yuri Perez, who was just mentioned, Paul Skeens, who we were just talking about, and more. Which pitching prospect who has not yet debuted will have the biggest impact in 2025? And I am definitely going to moderate this one and leave it to the prospect experts. Eric, who do you got?
This one was tough. I was debating between a few, really just two, but I'm going to go with Andrew Painter, you know, who almost debuted back in 2023. You know, there was, you know, when we were down in Florida, there was all those rumors like, is he going to make the opening day rotation? And then there was, oh, he has the elbow soreness. And then, you know, obviously it kind of spiraled out of control from there. And he ended up having Tommy John in late July of 2023. So by the time, you know, February, March rolls around, he's going to be, you know, 19, 20 months or something like that post-surgery. So plenty of time there. And yeah, maybe they give him, you know, a month or a little bit, just a little bit of time in the upper minors to kind of get back to the swing of things. But even if he comes up in May and pitches, you know, two-thirds, three-quarters of a season, I mean, this was a guy that was, you know, this Paul Skeens before Paul Skeens was drafted. I mean, look at the year that Andrew Painter had in 2022, you know, across three levels, low A, high A, double A, 22 starts, 1.56 ERA, 0.89 whip, and 103 and two-thirds innings, had 155 strikeouts to just 25 walks. You know, we like to, you know, use the term ace, you know, a lot, and I think that's reserved for only the maybe five pitchers in the minor leagues, and maybe even less than that right now. I'd have to go look, but there's not many that I use that ace term on. But when you look at all the boxes that I like to check off when, you know, projecting a future ace frontline pitcher, Painter has all those. And yeah, there's obviously, you know, some elevated risk here, even more so than most pitching prospects, just given the fact that he's going to be coming back from Tommy John. But we're looking at, you know, one of the, you know, when healthy, I think he's the most talented pitcher in the minor leagues. I am went with Jackson Jobe as well, who I think is the other one in that discussion for most talented arm in the minor leagues, and he should be up very early next year for Detroit and would be very good for a very long time. But as long as Painter's up, you know, by, you know, mid-May or so, maybe they even put him in the rotation. Maybe they see enough in spring training where they're like, all right, you're fine, you're healthy. Let's kind of do what we were going to do back in 2023 and just pop him right in there to start the season. I mean, I think you could see, you know, this is high praise, but you could see a Paul Skeens-esque season or pretty close to it. So, again, this was a tough one, but I will go with Andrew Painter.
I love that call out. And Andrew Painter is exactly the type of prospect where it's like was so hot when we were talking about him a season ago, gets injured, and it's people have this tendency to forget guys when they get injured and they get pushed down. And I love that call out a lot. Shelley, who is your pitcher who you think was going to have the most impact in 2025?
Yeah, I thought this was a very interesting question, but I went kind of with like a new kind of sort of like pop-up guy in Brandon Sproat. He's had a fantastic season. He was drafted in the second round by the Mets last year out of Florida. And I don't know, he might be the next awesome pitcher from Florida that the Mets drafted. They also drafted Christian Scott from Florida. So I don't know, maybe if the Mets draft any pitcher from Florida, maybe you should pay attention. But anyway, he has been absolutely fantastic this year. And while I don't think that he has the same ceiling as a Painter or a Jobe, I think if I'm going to take a gamble on a rookie pitcher, it's going to be a guy who I think is going to start the season with the team. And the Mets are losing Quintana and Severino from their rotation. We all know that the Mets and their owner, they like to spend money, so they might totally fix that. But losing two key pieces, they might just go ahead and give this guy a run. Don't look at his AAA numbers so far. He's pitched two games, and he has an 8.22 ERA. Don't look at that. That happens. But in high A and double A, he pitched extremely well. Great strikeout rates. You know, in 62 and a third innings at double A, he had a 16.8, so 17% swinging strike rate. That is great. Again, it's double A. It's not the majors. It's not even triple A. But that is something to go on. And again, if I'm going to take a gamble on a rookie pitcher, I want to get as many innings as I can. And if I believe in his talent, yeah. So I'm going to go with Sproat, and I could probably get him at a higher draft price or cost than I totally messed that up. Anyway, so Brandon Sproat, I think I can get later in drafts than Andrew Painter. So I'm going to go with that. And if he's bad, then I'll just drop him.
I was just thinking, I was like, I think the word is later. I was like, I always get stuck on the higher, lower draft thing.
Exactly,
like,
yeah.
He goes sooner, so he costs more. Anyway, we've created a language barrier for ourselves. Shelley, I love that call out. And I want to dive into it a little bit, because we've just spent a bunch of time talking about prospects who have sort of underperformed this year, or like, here are the guys who did perform that were not necessarily the guys that we thought were going to perform at the start of the season, or maybe they outperformed what we thought they were going to do, a la Jackson Merrill or something like that. You know, Wyatt Langford was not on the list that we were talking about. So I'm curious, I'm going to ask this question slightly differently. What is the threshold for a prospect being so good that you're like, no, I just have to push this guy up because he's great and I know he's going to be great, versus actually all prospects have some level of risk associated with them. They are definitely not promises. They are all going to struggle in different ways when they come up. And so you might as well just push those costs down towards the end of your draft board and not be so invested in a mid-rounds prospect pick.
For me, it's how I feel about the prospect. I went after Jackson Chirio, but he was going later than all the other high prospects, hitting prospects earlier this draft season. Yuri Perez, I was all over last year. Corbin Carroll was all over last year. But so it's more of how I feel about a player. And if I feel good and where their draft is going, I'll go ahead and I will take that player there. But I am not usually the one who only looks at the highest possible ceiling and that's what he's going to do kind of thing. That makes sense.
No, I think that makes a ton of sense. And honestly, I think it's probably the hardest thing in evaluating where you're going to draft a prospect for a redraft league, right? Like, prospect value in keeper leagues and dynasty leagues is a totally different thing, because you're looking at the multiple years of what they're going to learn and how they're going to do things. But I think that's a great comment. Eric, looking at Painter, who I agree is definitely a pitcher to keep an eye on here, is there anything in particular that you think is going to set him up for success in terms of either the arsenal he has, where the Phillies have some options for him, or other types of things? Or is it just a gut feeling like what Shelley was saying with Sproat?
Yeah, so it's always hard to definitively say, you know, what a pitcher's going to look like after they come back from major surgery. But given the fact that, you know, obviously he's nasty. You see the strikeout numbers. Like, this is a guy with upper 90s, you know, touching triple digits, fastball, you know, two big breaking balls, solid changeup. You know, he had all the stuff. But on top of that, just showing the command and, you know, of the entire arsenal, the strike throwing, you know, that gives me so much confidence in a young guy. That's why I'm, you know, so high on, you know, I was like, all right, go out and get Zebby Matthews, because this guy will just pound the zone and can really just put his pitches wherever he wants. Same with like Christian Scott. That's something I've come to value more and more. And, you know, that's why I devalue a lot of these guys that have the higher, you know, walk rates. You know, like Jack Leiter is an example I go to a lot. Even like Mick Abel, another Phillies arm who I used to love so, so much. And it was, I think, one of the first pitchers we ever talked about on the Toolshed podcast in our first episode back in 2020. And so it was hard to see him kind of fall off my out of my heart, so to speak. But, you know, the fact that Painter has, you know, or always had, again, hard to say what it'll look like when he comes back and then is throwing next spring. But the fact that he did have, you know, and not just like above average, we're talking like plus or better command of the arsenal. And the fact that he can miss bats, have that level of stuff, and then again command it so well, as a combination that is so rare to see, you know, especially these days. So that's kind of what gives you more confidence. So hopefully all those the boxes that were checked before surgery are still checked after surgery, but we shall see.
I'm really glad you brought up Mick Abel there, because I think about Mick Abel a lot. Mick Abel, somebody who I was pretty high on, just doing some like, hey, what might happen last season? And he really has, as you've noted, kind of fallen apart a little bit, and it is some command issues. And I think that we forget that prospects are not like, they're not finished products, and they're certainly not whatever has like paragraph has been written about them that is the highest level of upside they could have from different scouts and different evaluations. And I think that that's one of the things that makes prospect evaluation in particular really challenging. And I'm so glad to be able to learn a bit about it from both of you today. That's the best part of doing the show, is I just learn a lot from asking people questions about things. Do we have rebuttals here? Do we feel like we need rebuttals on this one?
I think not really. Honestly, if I had to pick one, with the highest ceiling, it would be Painter, and I hope he comes back. But I am very risk averse when I try to draft, so I'll take a gamble later with another prospect I like.
Yeah, and let me just like add a quick little note here that I will probably not have any shares of Painter next year, because unless, you know, kind of playing off of something Shelly said, you know, unless there's a project that I feel really strongly about, which I feel strongly about Painter in a way, but you know, it also, the draft cost, I think, though it's kind of hard to figure out where his draft class is going to be. Obviously the talent and the upside, the time miss, I don't know where that ADP is going to end up, but probably will be still fairly high, especially if he's trending towards, you know, making the rotation out of spring training or even a very early season debut, where usually for the first, you know, 150, 200 picks, I'm not going after any prospects unless it's someone that I'm like, all right, this guy's going to absolutely, you know, hit the ground running. Like I was that way with Langford this year. Didn't work out. I was also that way with Carroll last year as well, Shelly. That did work out. You know, we see, and Langford hasn't been like terrible, but obviously not what we expected. So it can bite you and it can work out well for you. So I will probably not have any shares of Painter, though maybe we'll see where the ADP ends up.
Yeah, it's a good reminder that like when you're making these decisions, there's a lot of major league talent around them too. And like whether you're going to invest in the guy you've never seen pitch at a major league level before or not is all wrapped up in who's still available on the board when you're making those decisions. Speaking of decisions, we are going to take one more quick break for our sponsors. On the flip side, we have a couple more debates, so stick around. All right. I'm going to take a step back on this one again, because we're going to flip this question just like we did earlier. And who is the hitting prospect that has not yet debuted that each of you believe will have the biggest impact in 2025? I'm super excited to learn a little bit more about these guys. And Shelly, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I'm going to be very odd and take a Marlins hitter. Like, why am I doing that? I should have taken like a Marlins pitcher, not hitter. But it's Augustin Ramirez for me. He came over in the Jazz Chisholm trade from the Yankees. Basically, he's a power hitting catcher, and he can put up good averages as well. But a power hitting catcher, they need catching. I mean, no offense to Nick Fortes, but that is their everyday starter. And they made a humongous trade to get this guy. Like, he was like the headline guy in that Jazz trade. And the Marlins, this might be news for a couple of y'all, have been quite bad this year. And they have a new GM. So they probably would want to have Ramirez up there opening day. Let's see what we got from this Jazz trade. Let's see how, you know, let's just put it all out there and let's just go. And again, catchers have been better. They have been trending better over the last couple of years. Like, you don't have like those Carlos Ruiz seasons when he was the Phillies and hitting like .190, right? Like, you can actually, and even two catcher leagues, you can have pretty decent catchers. So the catcher tag maybe isn't as important as it was a couple of seasons ago, but it still is pretty important. And if you can get a power hitting catcher who's probably going to hit in like the middle of the lineup, if he hits all of the bars, I'm going to take a gamble on that.
I love that gamble. Y'all know I love offense first catcher, and that's a great call out. I mean, I've been looking at the Marlins catching situation is sort of like a really these guys for about a season and a half now. So yeah, anytime you're willing to trade a talent like Jazz to get a prospect like that, I think that that's a playing time opportunity. Great call out. Eric, who is your bat that you're most interested in seeing in 2025?
Yeah, this one was a lot more kind of wide open for terms of selections than pitching was, I think. And I love the Ramirez pick as well. I don't think people still aren't fully realizing like how good he's been this season. And the fact that he's now had, you know, probably keeps that catch eligibility. Who knows what it would have been in New York. So I like that pick a lot from Shelley. I was very tempted to go with one of my, you know, Red Sox, you know, specifically Roman Anthony, but I will go to the Guardians and go with another prospect that I've been very high on, and people that know me know this, and that's Chase DeLauder, who's finally back. He's on a 9-game hitting streak right now, home run in 3 straight games. You know, obviously, the durability is a red flag and very concerning. It sucks that he probably would have already been up. I thought he was going to be a first-half call-up and one of those, you know, more advanced collegiate hitters that kind of, you know, go through the minor leagues fairly quickly. And probably, yeah, he probably debuted 3 months ago. If it hadn't been for the injuries, have limited him to how many games was it this year? Yeah, 33 games so far this year. So yeah, not a lot of, you know, time under the belt here in minor leagues. But when he has been on the field, whether it be spring training, you know, out in the Arizona Fall League last year, where he was one of the best players out there in terms of talent and production, and then lately he's showing that, you know, I think when healthy, this is a top 10 prospect for fantasy. I think, you know, we factor in the blend of, you know, solid contact skills, good approach, you know, that doesn't chase too often, doesn't strike out too often. The K rate's under 20% right now. Walk rate's above 10%. And then you get to the power, you get to the speed. You know, this is the potential 30 homer bat, 15, 20 steal guy. He actually, you know, reminds me, and I absolutely hate comparisons. I'm trying to do it, but he gives me some like young Christian Yelich vibe. He really does. So I'm not saying he's gonna turn into him, but kind of, you know, all the skills that he does have. And you know, I think he might even be a late season call up this year, maybe like a Evan Carter type thing, you know, get the call up for Cleveland and, you know, down the stretch run here and into the postseason. I wouldn't rule that out now that he's up at AAA now. Got the call up yesterday. So yeah, I think as long as he can stay healthy, that all around blend of offensive skills, he's got a, you know, higher floor than most, you know, prospects as well, given that he's got an advanced approach and then the power speed. So I think kind of put all that together, and if those feet can just stay together, you know, I think he's going to have a really good year next year and really provide, you know, well-rounded offensive profile. And then one last thing, if I hear one more person, you know, whenever I tweet about the louder, especially if it has a video in it, everyone comments on the swing. It doesn't matter. Whenever he makes contact, after that, he can do the hokey pokey for all I care. It doesn't matter. So people like to say the swing's ugly, but the skills are really good. I don't care what he does with the bat after he makes contact and drives to the ball. So love Chase DeLauder. I think he's going to be a very good player very soon.
Okay, I was going to ask a totally different question, but the ending there, I'm going to put my question a little bit. Eric, tell us a little bit more of what you mean by that in terms of like people looking at mechanics and trying to make judgments instead of looking at the actual results that a player has had and what how that plays into your evaluation of DeLauder in particular.
Yeah, so when people, the issues they have with DeLauder with the swing, it's all after the swing. I mean, and yeah, he's never going to be listed on, you know, oh, these are the 10 prettiest swings in baseball. He's never going to make that list. I know that. I'm never going to say the swing is aesthetically pleasing, but the fact that all the people are like, oh, look at the way he finishes. I mean, all right, he already hit the ball. It doesn't, you know, there's no issues with any mechanical thing, you know, from setup through making contact. So I think people just, you know, what the eyes see, and like, oh, that this looks ugly. I mean, okay, yeah, it does look ugly. I'm not going to sit here and argue with you, tell you that it doesn't look, you know, not that great. But the fact that everything is after the swing and the way he finishes, you know, with the bat whip, yeah, that doesn't look great. But he's already made contact. And he's already starting to, you know, run down the baseline at that point. So, you know, if there's issues with the swing and it's before, you know, any time from pre-pitch setup, you know, through leg kick and driving through the ball, yeah, that could be an issue and maybe something that leads to further issues down the road, but that's really not the case here with the Lauder. So I haven't let it, you know, affect my thought process or evaluation on him one bit.
Awesome. Thank you for diving into that with us. Shelley, I have a slightly different question for you. One of the things I like about these two picks in particular is that we've got a guy who is like on people's radar. We were all really looking forward to seeing DeLauder in the Arizona Fall League. And then we have a guy who has a slightly like position is wide open. You are going to get to play. And this is a potential stud who is going to get to play in that position. I love how you took into consideration sort of the overall playing context for evaluating the skill set of this player and how he might do as a prospect. Can you tell us a little bit more of what went into that?
Yeah. I mean, I've been a fan of Ramirez for a while. I don't think he's going to stick at catcher. And I think the Yankees kind of felt good with their Austin Wells and maybe Ben Rice kind of tandem at some point. I mean, Ben Rice might just be first base. So they had like, well, honestly, they have like a lot of catchers in their system. But it's like they had like all of this and, but they needed a third baseman. So they go get Jazz. But for me, he has the avenue, and that's what we kind of look for players. You look for optimal plate appearances, playing time. That's what you look for. And I just think that when I was like going through like my list of, you know, my top prospects, guys I like, guys who will most likely debut next year, as like, that was like the guy I pinpointed on. Like I would be shocked if he's not on the opening day roster. So that means he will not be on the opening day roster because the Marlins will do something funny. But yeah, again, it's a catcher. We always like the guy who, you know, he could play first base, right? So he could be like that everyday catcher who is not behind the plate. And that's always like a really fun thing too. So I just kind of zeroed in on Ramirez.
Hold on to that catcher eligibility as long as you can. Eric, if you had 1 minute to convince somebody that Chase DeLauder is the guy to invest in next season, what's your minute?
Yeah, so I would just go to the skill set that he has. You know, it's plus power, it's plus speed. Maybe he won't be a burner on the base pass and steal 30, but that he can give you, you know, 15, 20 steals. He can give you 25, 30 home runs while also hitting for a high average and a high OBP, and that's really what he's done. Outside of, you know, initially coming back from the injury, you know, earlier this season, I mean, look at what he did last year, hit 355, you know, with a 417 OBP, 5 home runs, 6 steals after the draft, and 242 plate appearances. And then this year, like, now that he's kind of settled back in, you know, you see that production really taking off. Like I said, 9-game hitting streak right now that he's on, 3 home runs, hasn't really been stealing much this year, but that can get turned back on, you know, easily with his speed. So, yeah, I just look at the all-around skills that he has, the approach he has, and he really just checks off all the boxes of what I look for in an impact player. And, you know, even if he doesn't debut late this season, which, again, I think is kind of 50-50 at this point, whether they bring him up, he's a guy that should easily be up either on the opening day roster or very, very early next season. So I kind of factored all that together, the talent, the proximity. That's why I think he's going to be a really great pick in drafts next year.
Awesome. Love that. I mean, I think he went in some drafts this year with people kind of anticipating that he might get a shot early this season, and then injuries got in the way there. Shelley, same question. If we're here next year, we're talking about the hitters who have broken out and Augustin Ramirez is that dude. Why did that happen?
Because I said so. That's why. Honestly, I think it's because he's going to get a lot of playing time and he has power. He's not a non-zero steel base guy. I mean, he's not going to be like a real Muto, right? He's not going to be like that, but he could probably give you, I don't know, 3-4. That's nothing. And he's got a good average. But I think it's going to be a playing time thing that's really going to help him out.
Playing time is king, y'all. It's one of the things I remind myself of during drafts all of the time. Let's get this last debate in before we move to our love it or leave it and end out this show. And this is a great question. I'm really excited to hear what both of you have to say about it. Let's take a step back from specific players. One of the things that is really challenging about this game is evaluating prospects based on the way scouting reports talk about them. And for hitters, there are 5 tools: running, throwing, fielding, hitting, and power. If either of you could give a player an 80 grade tool while all the others are in like the 35 to 40 range, which tool would you select to build the best possible fantasy baseball prospect? And Eric is our guest. You get to go first.
So I took a little bit of a different approach here. Is usually I would say hitting, but I'll let Shelly advocate for that. So I'll switch the power here because we've seen, you know, as long as it's 35-40 and not like 20, that's a much different story. But, you know, given, you know, let's say that person has a 35-40 grid hit tool, you know, we've seen players have pretty long careers, you know, cough, cough, Joey Gallo, cough, cough. You know, though his hit tool might even be lower than 35-40 grade, but we've seen hitters, you know, have pretty long careers, you know, even hitting just 230, 240, somewhere in that range. But, you know, hey, they give you, you know, they can give you 30 home runs, you know, a year. And they usually, you know, for the most part, you know, comes with additional RBI opportunities, driving in more runs. So I think that has the next biggest impact there, you know, as opposed to, you know, speed, which some people might choose. Obviously, speed is great. We love stolen bases, but I've seen so many guys that are, you know, 70, 80 grade speed prospects come up, but if they can't impact the ball, and like Victor Scott, I mean, I'm not saying he's not going to work out, but we've seen, you know, Victor Scott, Estrella Ruiz, I think those are the most two most recent examples, but there's so many more if we keep going back. That, you know, maybe they have a little bit of success here and there, but that prolonged success really isn't there if you're not making, you know, a good amount of contact and, you know, make impacting the ball. If you don't, you can't make that good impact, and then you're not going to really have a lot of, you know, a long career of making that high impact, especially for fantasy. So, but with power, we've seen some of those guys, you know, even, you know, like Rhys Hoskins, who I'd say might be a 40 grade hit tool type of guy. We've seen them kind of stick around and have some prolonged value. So if it's not the hit tool, which I think is always the most important, I will give the nod to power.
Yeah, I like this call out because one of the things that I've noticed, especially since the ball has stabilized-ish, is that power seems to be the scarcest thing in terms of drafts. Just like you can't count on, you know, Gleyber Torres to hit you 30 home runs. Like it's just like not like that's not a real thing. That's a distinct fluke that happened in a particular run environment that will probably not happen again. And it's made power really one of the lenses through which I build my draft strategy. So I appreciate the call out that power can keep you relevant in a fantasy baseball lineup longer than maybe some of the other tools. Shelly, what do you got?
Yeah, I'm going to go with, you know, hitting. This is probably evident in all of my dynasty leagues and honestly my redraft leagues. I struggle to find power. I used to say that I was like the Cleveland Guardians of managers. I just want hit tool. And then I'm like, why don't I have any home runs? So that's, I don't know. If you can't hit the ball, you're not really going to stick around. I mean, we have those oddballs who can kind of figure out dealing with kind of like a decent hit tool, but, you know, can really, you know, knock the ball out the park. But for me, the end all be all, you got to hit. And so if I'm gambling on a prospect and I know nothing else other than just scouting grades, give me the better hitter over anyone else.
I like that call out too, because frankly, like you can do a lot as long as you're making contact with a baseball. I mean, I was actually just kind of skimming through some recent prospects trying to figure out like who here has an 80 grade power tool versus who here has a potential 80 grade hit tool. Like they haven't really maxed that out usually when they're still prospects, right? Like even in their first few years in the league, you'll see something like 55 out of 80. Like this person could have an 80 grade tool at some point in time. But the guy that popped up on the power side of things, Eric, and I'm curious what you think of this, who might be a prospect that sort of lives in the wheelhouse of exactly what you're talking about, is James Wood, who has a game power and raw power tool that's at 55, 80, 70, 80, and then his hit tool sitting at 30, 40. Where do you think James Wood fits in this profile? Is that a guy that you're into in drafts next year?
Absolutely. James Wood, he's one of the few prospects. I mean, he's technically not a prospect anymore. Just graduated recently, but you know, I'll kind of lump him in with all the other prospects, you know, that has first round fantasy upside. You know, I still think Langford has it, Cheerio has it, but Wood might have the, you know, highest upside of them all. You know, and the fact that he's so big with so much power, but he's such a good athlete too. I mean, I think that's the thing that gets lost, is that he's such a good athlete. He's quick. He can steal bags. You know, the one issue is, you know, higher ground ball rate. You know, but we've seen him start to elevate more, and look at what he's done in the last, you know, month or so. He's been one of the best hitters in baseball. So yeah, James Wood, and I think there's still more room for power development too. I mean, he's still very young. I think he's still 21 years old. So I won't be surprised if there's even more raw power, even more than he already had this year. He was one of the, you know, look at the metrics in AAA. He was one of the best power hitters in AAA. Yeah, he didn't have, you know, he wasn't on like an Aaron Judge home run pace or anything like that. But the hard hit rate, the, you know, the EVs were there with James Wood, and just a matter of lifting the ball. Now that he is, you're seeing him really start to take off, and you know, I think he can be a huge impact player next year. So yeah, he's definitely one. You know, I wonder what the draft price is going to be, but if he continues doing what he's done the last month, over the final month, that ADP probably gets pushed. Maybe even top 30 to 40, maybe even higher than that. I won't be surprised. But in general, I'm very confident in James Wood.
Yeah, I was thinking that he sort of lands somewhere, probably not quite as high as we saw Ellie go last year, but maybe in the like Matt McClain range, yeah, where I think Matt McClain was going in like the fifth, sixth-ish round of drafts and hasn't really played this season at all due to injury, because the baseball gods are nothing if not capricious and fluky. Shelley, your player comp, who I found for a 80 grade hit tool and lower on the other parts, is Stephen Kwan, who I think that we see what Stephen Kwan does on a daily basis. He's super valuable fantasy player. Maybe he's not as fancy as the upside of a James Wood, but he's certainly more of a metronome that's going to give you that production day in, day out, and he's not going anywhere because the glove plays too. Tell me a little bit about that player type and what you like about it.
Yeah, the thing with Kwan, and I have him in a lot of redraft leagues, basically because he had a down season last year, and he was really, really inexpensive. But what I like about him is he is going to hit leadoff or at the top of the lineup. Like if you can get on base or hit, get on base, whatever, that well, you're going to be at the top, which means more plate appearances, which means if you have an average like Kwan, that's going to help your buoy your average overall. And then runs are a category. I try to get as many top of the lineup hitters in a draft as I can. Bully as many categories as you can. Yeah, again, that's probably why I stink at the home run category, because I'm getting all these leadoff hitters that hit like 320 and score, you know, 95 runs. So I got plenty of runs, but no home runs. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of the guy that I'm looking for. Yeah.
I mean, for every time Shelley is taking Stephen Kwan, I'm winding up with Kyle Schwarber, and then I'm looking at my batting average later and I'm like, what is wrong with my batting average? And I got like all the home runs, right? So there are trade-offs here, people. Like not everybody is a five tool player who's going 30-30 with excellent, all the skills. I love this debate because it's such a, it goes to what we're looking at in terms of how players are built and what we're trying to privilege in drafts. I'm going to give each of you 1 minute to make your case for your frame of either power or hit tool for prospects in particular. And then we'll move into our love it or leave it. Eric, as our guest, you can go first.
Yeah. So like I mentioned, I think hitting is the most important one, but you know, when it comes to for fantasy purposes, you know, as long as the hit tool is 35, 40 grade, so it's not complete, you know, 20 grade like Joe Adell, for instance, you know, the power brings the most, I think, impact to the table outside of the hit tool, you know, especially if, you know, you're in a good, you know, hitting in a good lineup, driving more runs, you know, obviously more home runs usually leads to more RBI, unless you're Tyler O'Neill, who has like, what, 19 home runs and 23 RBI this year, I swear.
Plus, one of my most rostered players, Tyler O'Neill. Sorry, continue.
No, me too. I forget what the home run and RBI told us, but I know he has like less than double RBIs to the home runs. The ratio is not good, which is weird because the Red Sox lineup has been pretty good this season. But anyway, back on point here. Yeah, this, the power impact that some hitters can bring. You know, like I said, we've seen some of these guys like the Reese Hoskins types that have long careers and that, you know, have been, you know, as Hoskins has kind of fallen off lately, but he was really, you know, a consistent power source for our teams for what he had a good, what, 5, 6, 7 year run, whatever it was, you know, hitting 30 home runs, you know, year after year after year and driving in 80, 90, 100 runs. So, yeah, I think that for fantasy purposes, I think, you know, if the, hit tool is at least not completely terrible. The power is the next most important for fantasy.
Yeah, great stuff. So to be clear, both of our debaters agree that the hit tool is probably the most important thing, but power is probably a strong second. Shelley, bring us home. What should people be looking for in an elite hit tool?
That's kind of what I want in a prospect. They're not as fun. They're not as sexy. They're not as cool. They won't get as many tweets from the community. Just a good hitter. But you need to hit to stay in the league. Yep. And you could probably get them for a cheaper cost. So that's kind of how I view things.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. This has been so fun. And as always, I have learned a ton. But on this show in particular, just hearing two of my favorite prospect people talk through how you evaluate prospects and why has been great. Eric, remind people where they can find your work on prospects and other things and what you're working on right now.
Yeah. So, you know, you follow me on Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it these days, at EricCross04. I write, you know, usually one or two articles a week at FTN Fantasy and Rotoballer as well. And then plenty, you know, most of my content now is over on my Patreon, which you can get to, you know, I linked in my bio, but it's also toolshedfantasy.com. That's where all my rankings are now. I try to do, you know, almost close to daily, just, you know, recaps of, you know, what happened in the minor leagues and the major leagues in the previous day and what it means moving forward, you know, from a dynasty and redraft perspective. So trying to hit on a lot of things, and yeah, it's finishing the season strong, but am looking forward to a nice little break, you know, in the next month or so. And we love what we do, obviously, but it's a long season. You get to close to September, it's like, all right, I'm ready for a little bit of a breather before, you know, the fall league and all that stuff kicks off. But yeah, thanks for having me on. This has been really, really fun.
Oh, of course. Thank you so much for joining us, and can't wait to see both of you at First Pitch Arizona, our routine First Pitch Arizona pitch here on the podcast. We'll let end things the way we always do with our love it or leave it. One thing from baseball news this week you are either super into or over. Eric, kick us off.
Yeah, so I'm going with one I'm super into, and I came across this tweet the other day. It was a tweet on the 18th, so 2 days ago now. So Logan O'Hoppe's father, Michael, apparently had cancer a few years ago, but he's now been cancer-free for 2 years. And to celebrate the achievement, Logan and his family invited 350 people to watch him play at Yankee Stadium last week. But one guest in particular that stood out was his dad's oncologist, a doctor named Dr. Oscar, I might butcher this, Lahoud. It's L-A-H-O-U-D, so apologies if I said that name wrong. But this really hit home close to me. I don't usually talk about my personal life a lot on Twitter, but this was right around the same time my father was also battling cancer, and thankfully he beat his as well, and that was right around 2 years ago. So similar time frame, you know, and I know what you have to go through and what my dad went through, what the family goes through. So this one really just hit close to home, and, you know, always a feel good, you know, because cancer sucks, you know. It really does. It's affected so many people, so many families, you know, across the world. And the fact that when someone beats it, I think that's something to really, really celebrate, really just, you know, give you that positive, uplifting feel like, hey, you know, this person just beat this, you know, life threatening illness that has taken so many lives. So just to see that, you know, O'Hoppe's father, you know, beat cancer, and that they celebrated, brought the doctor out, because, you know, doctors are phenomenal. The fact that, you know, what they do to help these people, you know, survive and hopefully beat this disease. And, you know, these people should be celebrated. And the fact that they included the doctor, you know, in that, you know, that massive group to come out and watch Logan play at Yankee Stadium was just really, really encouraging, really just heartwarming to see. So, again, kind of get close to home with me. So I was like seeing those positive things on Twitter, so much negative crap these days. So something like that should be really, you know, shared around, celebrated. So that was kind of a nice uplifting thing to see earlier this week.
I love that. And they should absolutely celebrate the heck out of all of it. What Logan's dad did, what his doctor did, all of it. And we will certainly include a link to that tweet in the show notes so that everybody else can go back and like it. Maybe we can give it a little bit more run and get more eyes on it. Absolutely love that. Shelley, what is your love it or leave it this week?
Mine's going to be, I have a second favorite player. Obviously Juan Soto will be my favorite player. And so he retires for many reasons. But Francisco Alvarez, I think, is my second favorite player. I don't know if everyone saw him hit a, you know, walk-off home run against the Orioles on Monday night, but it was absolutely fantastic. It was a 3-0 pitch, and they let him swing. And he hit this ball, and when he hit it, he knew it. And it was absolutely fantastic. His reaction, he knew it. He was like, yeah, yeah, and the whole team, I don't know, I'm really falling in love with the Mets. I don't know what's wrong with me. But the whole team is just like, yeah, just like celebrating. And I love him as a player. I love him as a catcher. Like, if you see him like behind the plate, he's always trying to encourage his pitchers. You can see him being like, yeah, do this, do that. Yeah, that was a good pitch. Let's try to get it here or whatever. Just everything about him, I absolutely love. And I don't know. I find him so much fun.
I also find him incredibly fun. And let me just tell you, that's a power over hit tool, Francisco Alvarez, 70 grade power tool there for the Mets young catcher, but truly an electric player. I also, fun fact about Francisco Alvarez, when the players drop off their visiting buses over by Wrigley Field, every now and again I catch them because I'm walking to get coffee or run an errand or whatever. And there was one guy waiting out there with his jersey to get it signed by Francisco Alvarez, and he's just like screaming and yelling to get Francisco Alvarez's attention, and he was so gracious and awesome, just like signed the thing immediately, and they had a conversation. I love seeing that from players too, just knowing that they're appreciating the moment.
Yeah, I love to hear that.
Same.
Mine is also related to that sort of area by Wrigley where the visitors come out, because one of the great things you get to see if you live near the friendly confines is the rookie coffee run, which I don't think every team does, but most teams do when they come to Wrigley Field towards the end of the year. And it's super fun to see. They basically send all the rookies out. And I'm not a fan of hazing generally, but this is like very low key, just kind of give them a moment. And the players seem to love it. So, the rookie players will all come out in full uniform and walk across the street there at Addison to the Starbucks and bring back the entire team's coffee order. But what's truly magical about this one is the Blue Jays media team posted it, and you can like see the players just having a blast. They're like taking selfies of themselves and Instagramming. They're like, I'm at Wrigley Field, check this out. And then they go get the coffee and the baristas love it. And if you need a moment of zen, a moment of joy, check out one of the visiting coffee runs at Wrigley Field for the rookies and how players interact with fans when they're in full dress right outside the friendly confines.
Yeah, I saw that over the weekend. It was really awesome.
It's pretty sweet, honestly. I like it better than all of the old hazing rituals that they used to do. We're looking forward to which of the prospects we talked about today will be those rookies next year getting coffee for our favorite teams when they come to visit Wrigley Field. Shelley, where can people find you and your takes about those rookies when that happens?
Yeah, you can apparently find all of my Augustin Ramirez tweets on Twitter. Apparently, I'm the Augustin Ramirez guy. Gal. Ooh. Find me on Twitter, ShelleyV_643.
Awesome. You can find me and my rookie takes at @BCB_Sarah. There's no H on the Sarah. You can find the podcast at PL Fantasy Feud. Please follow us. It's our inaugural, it's our rookie season. And every follower and every engagement and every retweet matters. We've had a blast bringing this show to you so far. Looking forward to many more shows in the future. And we'll be back next week with all of the fantasy baseball debates to inform how you can take home your league this year.